Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
And I suppose I should also say happy World AIDS Day, a day that for the first time since 1988, the U.S. government is not acknowledging the existence of. This, according to a memo sent out by the State Department, telling its employees and its grant recipients not to do anything concerning World AIDS Day or issue any official communications about it. It seems like a rather fraught symbolic position for the U.S. government to take. How's this going over in public health circles?
In public health circles, I would say that everyone feels that that decision was deplorable. It makes no sense at all, and it's cruel. I don't know what else to say, Brian.
I mean, of all of the high-profile infectious diseases, this is the one that, like, modern-day Republicans could actually claim a feather in their cap over. It was the George W. Bush administration that put together some of the initiatives that started to really beat back the worldwide spread of HIV.
Right. Well, those were the days when diseases and public health issues and medical issues were not politicized. We're not living in that era anymore. We're living in an era where our government is controlled by ideologues.
All right. Speaking of ideologues, I wanted to start today's discussion with some of the maneuverings among Trump appointees at the Food and Drug Administration, namely Vinay Prashad, who sent out a memo a few days ago alleging that staff working under his supervision have found 10 cases in which childhood COVID vaccination has likely caused the death of a child. And on that basis, they are overhauling how the FDA will review vaccines for approval. This is a lengthy letter from someone who followed a career trajectory from academic to YouTube contrarian star during the pandemic straight to the Trump administration. What do you make of it?
Well, on a personal level, I read it when it came out, the memo, and it ruined my day. but it didn't surprise me. As you mentioned, during the COVID pandemic, this doctor wasn't not only an ideologue, but clearly distorted a lot of data to make his own points and his own end. He was not particularly interested in science and the truth. And he's continuing this position now while he's in authority, and it's much more dangerous than it was when he was just speaking publicly or without this position. So the claim that he's making is that at least 10 children died from the COVID vaccine. He gave absolutely no data on how he or and his underlings reached this decision. I do know from talking to others that there's considerable disagreement within his area at the FDA by career scientists and by really strong people in terms of strong academic people. So this is really an idea that he has and has had for a long time that he's applying to his view of the data that he's seeing and reaching conclusions. Now, I can't say that he's wrong because he gave us no information about any of those 10 cases. So no one's had an opportunity outside of he and his the people that the FDA commissioner, Marty Makary, appointed, have looked at it. So I can't critique what he's saying beyond saying that I'm very, very skeptical.
I read his letter too. Let me summarize it as best I can as a layperson, and ask you to critique my layperson's understanding of it. So what I understand him to say is, I had somebody go through data from the VAERS system. That's the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is self-reported data. Anybody can say I've had a negative impact from a vaccine. And he says she used a conservative method to go through that data and came to the conclusion there were 10 cases of childhood deaths probably related to vaccination out of 96 total that we examined. And then he further goes on to say that in the course of approving COVID vaccinations for use in children, there was not much by way of randomized controlled trials to determine the safety and efficacy of the vaccine specifically in children, and lays out a claim that's been a hobby horse of his for some time, that because of a slight risk of cardio complications, cardiomyopathy from COVID vaccination, particularly in younger boys, the vaccine may be worse for them than the risk of getting the illness while unvaccinated, which is much less in children than in older people. How did I do at summarizing the main claims of his letter?
As usual, you summarized it very nicely.
Okay, so let's walk through kind of the top line claims. Again, he didn't say anything about their methods through going through the VAERS data. So there's nothing really to contest methodologically there. But the longstanding argument from Vinay Prashad that the use of COVID-19 vaccines in children doesn't have enough data to support it. What is the counter to that argument?
Well, the counter to the argument, it's a very nuanced issue. The vaccine in children who have previously been vaccinated, the role of the vaccine in otherwise healthy children, there is a very vigorous discussion going on about how important it is, because otherwise healthy children outside of the infancy age who have previously been vaccinated, that is, have been exposed to the properties of this virus and have some degree of immunity, they have a very low incidence of complications from having COVID. Still, some do, and tragically, some, not very many, die. But there is a reasonable debate about the role there. But it brings us to really the question of how do you make policy for 330 million people in terms of vaccine policy? And you don't make it by making wild claims like Prasad is making and then changing the policy for children or for any group or for the entire population. You make it by having independent people look at the data. For example, the National Academy of Sciences could look at the data and critique it. So we'd have other eyes on this data. And then you would make decisions based upon independent look at the data and perspective and reach a conclusion that is best for the population in terms of advice. That's not the way this is being done. He's recommending that significant changes in vaccine policy occur. And it's interesting, Brian, with the timing of this. This came out less than a week before the ACIP, the committee that advises the CDC, is meeting, I believe it's this Thursday, to discuss these kinds of topics. So essentially, what's being happened is an orchestrated program to present to the American public that the FDA and the ACIP are going to advise ch significant changes based upon no critical view, no independent view. As we know, I think all of your listeners now know, the ACIP is not composed of people who are independent scientists. They have they themselves are ideologues, perhaps except for one of the people on the committee. Also want to point out that's tangential to the point you were making, is that the person who raised this issue several months ago, Dr. Haig, is a physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist in private practice, a private practice physician, and an associate researcher at UC Davis. She is not an expert in infectious disease. She is not an expert in vaccinology. She has no training in that area. She's a researcher in those areas that I mentioned. She's the one who raised the issue that children were dying of the vaccine several months ago. And she's the one who Prasad asked to do this critical review with him. So these are the two people who did this critical review, probably with some career scientists working with them from the FDA. So this is, I can't help but thinking this is, as I mentioned, an orchestrated event that's in concert with what we'll be seeing coming up later at the end of this week.
What do you understand Prashant to be signaling about changes to the vaccine approval process?
Well, we've heard him mention this on several occasions throughout the summer and late spring, actually. He is interested in slowing down the production of vaccines, although he would not say that. The way he's interested in doing that is by making the hurdles for the pharmaceutical companies that produce the vaccine so high that it will be very difficult for them to achieve those hurdles, and especially achieve them in a time that's most important for the American public. That is, when a new variant, for example, a subvariant of COVID comes out or of influenza, he's going to set up demand double-blinded controlled trials, which would be really impossible to do in any kind of timely fashion, and would be unnecessary because of the policy, the way we've been doing it for a number of decades now with influenza. So I think what this is it's a way, clearly obfuscating exactly what their intent is, and their intent is to make vaccines less available to the American public. You know, if vaccines really were something that were terribly controversial, that we're really not sure how important they are in terms of saving lives, that if we didn't have really close to 100 years, actually more if you include smallpox vaccine, of experience with them, if those things weren't true, then I could see raising substantive questions about the production of vaccines, about who should get them, about the childhood schedule, et cetera. But we have decades of data that clearly show the millions, hundreds of millions of lives worldwide, and millions of lives here in the United States just in the last, since the 21st century, that have been saved by vaccines. So when you're talking about changing the vaccine schedule, making vaccines more difficult to produce, et cetera, you're really tampering with something that's terribly important to the public's health, and you better have very good data with lots of different eyes on that data before you make any kind of changes.
Speaking of Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health, and he is here to, among other things, answer your questions. 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. That is 1-800-958-9008 for all questions COVID and other infectious diseases that circulate this time of year. Dr. Swartzberg, I guess we should move on to some of the questions that have come into our inbox. It is going to be a very dramatic pivot from talking about current events in the Trump administration. But John in Burlingame wrote during the post-Thanksgiving haze to thank you for your discussion of the importance of cooking poultry all the way through, especially when bird flu is in circulation. He asks, my question is regarding chicken eggs. Do they also need to be cooked with the same thoroughness as chicken or turkey?
That's a great question from John. The big risk of chicken eggs, we have not seen any evidence that bird flu transmits through eggs, but theoretically, it's possible. To be very, very careful with eggs, we really worry about salmonella. And cooking eggs thoroughly does kill the bacterium and certainly would destroy the virus, any virus. So that's probably the best general advice. What does that translate to? It translates to your scrambled eggs being cooked so they're not runny. It translates to eggs sunny side up. Maybe not the best idea, that the yolk should be really cooked through. Now, all of that said, the risk is exceedingly low from contracting any disease, especially, as I mentioned, salmonella from eggs, but it can occur and certainly has been described. So people really at risk for not handling a salmonella infection, for example, should really cook their eggs thoroughly. People that are at very low risk and they really want to eat their eggs that are sunny side up and not thoroughly cooked through, well, they're living maybe a little bit on the edge, but not much.
All right, John in Burlingame, I am sorry to disappoint you about the sunny side up eggs you were eating earlier. He went on to describe his typical egg preparation process in more detail later in the letter, but I excerpted it for the sake of brevity. Let's go to our phone lines, 1-800-958-9008. First caller is Dan, calling in from all the way in Ithaca, New York. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Brian and Dr. Swartzberg. I have a question for Dr. Swartzberg. Can you clarify for me RFK Jr.'s rhetorical communication style? It seems to me that when he makes a claim, it's fundamentally a scientific claim. But when he's asked to clarify or he's challenged, he responds by saying he's not a scientist or a medical researcher, therefore, he can't answer. This is very Trumpian at its core, and I'm just wondering if this is your observation and if you have any comments about it.
Thanks, Dan. I think you nicely describe a characteristic style that he has of making points. When you said that he makes a scientific claim, what he does is he makes a scientific claim based upon either no science, that is, there's no published paper that supports his claim, but by just saying that there's science to support what he's saying, it gives it some heft. Well, when we look at the science, the claims that he makes, when there are papers that support that, and when we critically look at those papers, they're really, so often, they're really outliers. and no one in the field pays any attention to them. They're often published in obscure journals. Their quality is usually very poor, but he and his group have been able to find these articles to support his statements. So it again lends credence to what he's saying to someone who's not familiar with the literature. We can look at, for example, his publication that came out about nutrition, when the references that were used, some of them didn't exist at all. They were clearly found by AI, quote, found by AI. And some of the references were completely contrary to what he was saying. We can look at the recent Tylenol fiasco, claiming that Tylenol given to babies would cause autism. The science supporting that was essentially non-existent. But he makes the claim by saying that there's a paper that mentions this. Oftentimes, and in one case with this with Tylenol, the paper did study this, or it looked at it tangentially, and concluded that there was not really good evidence, but he flipped that around. So it's an effective style when you're talking to people who are outside of the particular field that he's talking about. It's an effective style that attorneys use, and he, although he never passed the bar, he was an attorney. So he's familiar with this style, but it's not a style that we use to really try to understand the truth.
Oh, I think he did eventually pass the bar. He just had several failed attempts in his youth before he got there. But being part of the Kennedy clan gets you a lot of do-overs. I think, Dan, if you want to read up on that particular rhetorical style, which you identified very aptly, you might enjoy Googling the Mott and Bailey fallacy, M-O-T-T and B-A-I-L-E-Y fallacy, which is an argument style where someone makes a very strong claim, and then when they are challenged on it, says that was never their claim in the first place and retreats to something more defensible. And in his case, it's often a, I'm just asking questions. That doesn't really work when you're in a position who's in charge of making policy. You know, policy isn't science. It's based on the best evidence available. There's always some amount of uncertainty, and there's a balancing act around relative harms of action and inaction. You can't just say, I'm just asking questions, or we need more research, and calling it call it a day, because decision paralysis will kill people in the public health field. Anything to add, Dr. Swartzberg?
No, but thank you for correcting me about RFK passing the bar after several attempts.
All right. We've got time for one more quick caller. John is on the line in the North Bay. Good morning, John.
Hi. Thanks for your show, and I try to catch it every week. And thank you to KPFA for existing. My one big concern is about the bird flu. Now, I had heard somewhere they do have or they're working on a vaccine for it. But if the doctor could give some more information about it.
Sure. We're short on time, so we'll go straight to Dr. Swartzberg. Yeah. What's in the pipeline for bird flu vaccination?
Yeah. Thanks, John, for the call. There's lots of work on developing an avian influenza vaccine. There's one just in the last few weeks that really showed some promising results. The vaccines for humans, as well as vaccines to protect birds. So there is work on this. There's not as much work as one would like. Some of the listeners may recall that roughly about $500 million towards development of a bird flu vaccine in the spring was canceled by RFK Jr. Still, there are other scientists working on this. So fingers crossed that we'll have something.
All right. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. That does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.